Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. It is me, your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those of you checking this out for the very first time, I say thank you and well-timed. This is episode 100. The fabled 100, the 100 that so few podcasts actually get to. So I am absolutely thrilled to still be in this game, fighting like Mike Tyson biting off Evander Holyfield's ear. Just keep going on all costs. So what I want to do today is just quickly give you an overview of who's on the show, and it's a fantastic show, and then just do a brief 2 to 3 minute monologue about what I've learned over this journey, about myself and about the guests and all of that. So today on the podcast, I had the pleasure to interview the man, what do they call him? The master of disaster. Dr. Randall Bell. He has a very fascinating career. His career is really predicated around going to disasters, Katrina, 9/11, O.J. Simpson trial, Chernobyl, and assessing the economic damage that was caused on behalf of his clients. It's fascinating. And we sit down and talk about his new book, We, Me, Do, Be, and it's his basic learnings over the last 25 years of doing this job and how it kind of comes back to you, the person. So really interesting conversation. I think I dug a little bit too hard onto an issue that he had early on in his life, so maybe slightly aggravated him, but I think he comes around towards the end. So stay tuned today for Dr. Randall Bell, the author, Master of Disaster, the author of Me, We, Do, Be. It's a fantastic book and an easy read. So, you know, when you do 100 episodes in anything, 100 anything, you learn a lot about yourself. You know, this process of finding guests, interviewing, producing, editing, it's quite time consuming. And a lot of people who have the resources, and God bless them, are able to farm a lot of this stuff out. I just don't. So I spend on average between 5 and 10 hours a week just editing and producing the podcast, not counting the hours I spend interviewing guests and prepping for guests and things like that. It really is fascinating when you start looking into the time and energy that goes into this. It's not a wonder that a lot of individuals who start out podcasting think how simple or easy it's going to be, and then soon find out that it is actually time-consuming and painful. So I don't blame them for saying to themselves, I don't love this that much. I'm going to spend my time other places. Unfortunately for me, or fortunately for me, depending on what side of the coin you want to look at, I love this. I love talking to people. I love learning about their lives and their journeys. And over the last 100 episodes, there's just a few things that you learn about yourself, though. First thing I kind of learned is that I'm pretty okay. My life is really good. I've got a great life. I've got a great wife, and I've got, you know, great 4 kids. And you always just do the best you can with what you can, with what you know. And so this kind of comes out along this journey, talking to various CEOs, executive consultants, book authors, whatever. And the other thing you really find out is that everyone has their own journey. And I think we all know this, but to what degree it's different than yours or same than yours is up for conversation. But I always find that at the end of all of these, you know, having lived all around the world and traveled, I think, and I preach this sometimes, and I use the word preach quite strongly, actually, is that we have so much more in common as humans and humanity than we have not in common. And I hope that, you know, through my podcast, not only do we learn about these executives' journeys and their aspirations and the fact that many of them are paper boys when they're paper girls when they're children, and the fact that we learn that hard work starts when they're when kids are around 10 or 12. And these are fascinating lessons. You know, the other lesson you learn is that people, how people see themselves. You know, I ask a lot of questions in my Fast Five around figuring out people's self-concept. Who are they? How do they perceive themselves? And do those Fast Five questions match with the story they're telling? And only you, the audience, knows that. Only you can tell me if you see the connection or not. And so, you know, over the last 100 episodes, and I hope I have 300 more, just with some more help down the road from a time perspective, I hope I can continue telling these stories. Because as much as I believe we have more in common than not, we all can learn from everyone's individual story. How does someone become the CEO of Will.com or the master of disaster on today's episode? And what triggers in their life drove them? You know, as I've talked about in tangential comments throughout the last few weeks, you know, I have a book that I'm writing on authentic leadership. And I'm not, by any stretch of the imagination, the first to come to this theory. But I have a little bit of a different perspective than what's done out there. And, you know, one of the major theories that comes out in a lot of these books is the idea of a crucible, some major event, some moment in time that we as an individual stop, pause, and take a look at where we're at and what learnings through the failures that we had in that moment, in that crucible, that we can take, twist, and use as a springboard to the future. And that's what I love most about my podcast, is finding out these individuals' crucibles. What was it in their life that created this twist? Was it in a childhood? Was it a failure in adulthood? So anyhow, I think at the end of this long, long conversation that I'm having to myself in my office that is sweltering hot right now because I'm in the Middle East, is thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for those of you who have been with me from the start. Thank you from the bottom of my heart of those who are joining the journey. And all I ask is that you just spread the word. You know, if you like what I do, you know, I know it's an hour long. I know we have a hard time finding an hour. But that's why I try to encourage you or want you to do this while you work out. Go for a walk. Get some me time. And, you know, spend that time listening to these people's journeys so you can reflect about your own life and how lucky we all are. You know, we all have problems and situations that aren't great. You know, this is part of life's peaks and valleys. And just know that we all have them and we all can get through them. So, again, thank you so much for just allowing me to have this forum to do this and to share with you a little bit about myself and my life and my beliefs and my thoughts and my what I believe is a unique style in interviewing. So have a great week and enjoy today's episode with Dr. Randall Bell, the master of disaster, the author of Me, We, Do, Be. Have a great week.
I made a fortune writing myself letters. My heart is made of stone now. On top of everything, there's a layer of snow. And something about the weather, my mama told me not to go outside.
Come on. So now, do you prefer to go by Dr. Randall, Dr. Bell, Dr. Bell Randall, Dr. Randall Bell?
Well, full name Dr. Randall Bell, but you can either call me Randall or Dr. Bell. I really don't care.
Okay. So now where are you located at?
I'm in Laguna Beach, California.
Oh, that sucks. I mean, so are you from Laguna Beach?
I'm from Orange County. I grew up in Fullerton where they made Fender guitars.
Ah. So
yeah.
So what was it like back when you were in Orange County? Because I feel like it's probably evolved, that whole area, since you were raised.
Well, it's built out a lot. I mean, when I was a kid, it was all orange groves, but now it's, you know, wall to wall, you know, developed.
Yeah. Right. And so do you, because how far is Laguna Beach from Orange County? I feel like they're fairly close to each other.
No, Laguna Beach is in Orange County. It's one of the cities in Orange County.
Oh, okay. Well, that tells you how little I know about it then. So were you like a surfing kid, a swimming kid, or a water polo kid growing up?
I wish I was all of the above, but I was actually a open heart surgery kid. I distinctly remember I was born with a congenital heart defect. And when I was about 10 or 11, I remember standing on the Acacia Elementary schoolyard saying, why out of all these hundreds of kids, am I the one that has to go in the hospital for the whole summer? I was not happy about it.
So was that a common thing? Like every summer? I mean, that's probably overkill.
Well, I mean, that's how I had to spend a summer. The good news is once they finished it, did the surgery, I was good to go. I passed an FAA medical and, you know, they did a brilliant job fixing me. But, you know, until I was 11, I was kind of, you know, a bit of a mess.
So what did that do psychologically for you in your teens? I mean, did that drive you to be more active, or did that make you feel like... let me ask you this question. Was your mom, maybe your dad, but I always feel like a mom, was your mom much more risk adverse at that point then?
I wanted to do all the stuff that kids did. And, you know, my mom never said, you know, much. If anything, she kind of concealed everything from me. But you know, I had the surgery, and psychologically, you know, to that part of your question, it kind of made me think that I couldn't do what other kids do. I grew up thinking I couldn't run as far or as fast as other kids. And that was true until I had the surgery. But after that, I was physically completely healed. But mentally, I still had this mindset that I couldn't do what other kids could do. And it wasn't until my last year of high school that the head basketball coach saw me playing tennis. And he said, man, I really wish you'd stuck with basketball because you'd be starting right now. So that's the day I realized that I had let the whole, you know, the whole mindset shut down and hold me back from what I was capable of doing.
And so did you make me, obviously, you know, you have this PhD and we'll get into that in a little bit, but, you know, did you have siblings that you were around in that process? And like, were they super active? Was there resentment in that way?
I have two brothers and four sisters, but they were mostly older than me and kind of out of the house. But, yeah, I come from a big family, but no, they didn't really hold me back. I mean, they would tease me a little bit, but, mm-hmm. but it wasn't really an issue with that. It was more in my own head.
Yeah. Isn't that funny how that works though? Like everyone can tell you you're fine, but yet you have this little ounce of doubt that just kind of lingers. Were you ever able to kind of, from a physical standpoint, move that out of your psyche? I mean, I know you talked about your senior year, but did that make you want to go and be more active, or did it still kind of linger in the background?
No, I lingered in the background. I let it hold me back, and I was so upset with myself when I realized that the doctors had been successful. I had been totally fixed, and the only thing holding me back was my mindset. You know, but on the positive side, you know, once I kind of realized that, I thought, hey, wait a minute, you know, I really conscientiously thought this. I thought, you know, I've really been an idiot, you know, to think that, you know, I can't do stuff. And that's when I just kind of started blazing ahead. I mean, it was like a kid in a candy shop. I just thought, hey, I can do anything. And that's when I kind of went for it.
That's awesome. And so when that switch happened, was it almost, I would imagine it's like a sense of freedom.
Big time, you know, because I just realized, I mean, the surgery left a big scar on my back. That was another kind of psychological thing because, living in Southern California and at the beach and everything. But you know what? I just thought, you know what? I've been held back too much with my mindset. I'm just blazing ahead. Screw it all. I'm going for it.
So do you see yourself as a super competitive person?
I don't know that I'm competitive with others, but I'm very competitive with myself. I'm always kind of challenging myself, and I'm always putting myself into really challenging positions and situations. And I'm not so much trying to beat the other guy. I'm more trying to beat myself and beat what I did yesterday with what I do with today's performance. I know that sounds maybe a little cliche, but that's really how I think.
Cliches are developed out of sheer reality that has happened sometimes somewhere at some point.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, one thing that I forgot to even ask you, just to kind of give my audience a quick 10,000 foot view of yourself, can you just quickly introduce yourself? Because I know you've done all sorts of incredible stuff with 9/11 and, I don't know why the JonBenet Ramsey case is stuck in my head, and then Katrina. So can you just quickly give me a quick 10,000 foot view?
Sure. I'm basically an economist, and later I went back to school and studied sociology, but I study disasters. So you mentioned the World Trade Center and Hurricane Katrina, the BP oil spill. You know, I've done hundreds of these cases. I did work on JonBenet Ramsey and O.J. Simpson and the Heaven's Gate Mansion, just, as I say, hundreds of them. I wrote a textbook, which I don't even want to get into, but, you know, it's a 500-page textbook on the technical aspects of measuring the economics of a disaster or a tragedy, something like that. But I learned a long time ago, James, that behind the dollar signs, behind the statistics, are real people. And I think the big pivotal turning point that got me into sociology was there's a few instances. Once when I was at Chernobyl, and I was at a military outpost waiting for my paperwork to get processed to get into the restricted zone, and all these military guys had machine guns. It was lunchtime, and they brought out sandwiches and vodka. And I thought, you know what? I know I'm not that bright, but vodka and machine guns seems like a really stupid combination. And I thought,
I think
it depends
on the crowd that you're asking, actually. So
regardless of the crowd, I felt a little uncomfortable. But yeah. I thought, you know what? I don't think it's an accident the world's biggest nuclear disaster occurred in a culture where this is okay. I mean, it's just so stupid. And then I had another instance where I was working on the O.J. Simpson case, and I was at the Browns' home, and I was there when Denise was very well, and they were all very upset with the whole situation, the trial, the loss of their sister. And Denise got this idea to channel all her energy into helping battered women, which I thought was, and I still think is, super cool. And I thought, you know what, behind all these statistics that I'm measuring, I'm going to pay more attention to the people and their behaviors. And that's kind of where my whole area of success research has evolved from.
So I guess, you know, if I can unpack that a little bit, what I'm trying to understand is why disasters, like how did that become something that you were interested in?
I actually started my career doing real estate valuations for banks and stuff, and I enjoyed it, but I wanted to do something else. And I applied to law school, and I got in. And the day before law school classes started, I was floating in the pool, and I thought, you know what? I just don't know that I want to be a lawyer. I don't know the world needs another lawyer. And if it doesn't, I don't know if it's me. So I faxed, it was back in the days of faxing. I faxed my resignation in. I thought, what if I take my skill set and I take, instead of looking at what creates value, I look at what loses value. And instead of doing an appraisals, I do, you know, the legal term is diminution value. And I thought, you know, that would be fascinating to really specialize in that. And so, like I said, I faxed my resignation in law school, and I was taking a big chance, but it blasted off with all the, you know, Southern California and the wildfires and the earthquakes and the floods. I've always been extremely busy with hundreds and hundreds of cases.
There can't be that many of quote unquote Dr. Randall Bells out there, are there?
There's not that many. There's a few, but it's a pretty small niche. Yeah.
You know, I think about this guy who struggled athletically because of his mental block about it. And then I have to always wonder, he's also internally driven, competitive with himself. Is that where this drive of academia came in to get the sociology PhD or PhD, right? Sociology?
Yeah, right.
And then, you know, also economists, you know, like you have this constant drive to succeed. Do you think you, in some ways, psychologically, whether you were conscious about it or not, kind of compensated with the academic because you had control of that process?
I think I did. I did. I, like any, at least a lot of kids, as a young boy, I really wanted to be an athlete. And, you know, but it just wasn't going to happen with my heart situation. And frankly, I wasn't that great of a student. I was kind of your B minus student. And I didn't get it the first time teachers said something. I just didn't get it. And I thought, you know, but I did. I conscientiously channeled my energy into not so much academia, but schooling and kind of pioneering, you know, fields mentally at least. And I kind of changed focus when I realized that I was limited in the physical side that I wanted to do.
But yeah, but you know what I hear though? You also want to prove to people, like in some ways you're out to prove yourself, right? So, because, you know, and the only reason why I say that is that, you know, I was an awful student. And when you say you were B minus, I was C on a good day. But at some point I decided that I got tired of being labeled X and that I wanted to prove people wrong and that I wanted to be labeled Y. And
yeah,
that has been my drive ever since, to probably my own personal demise. But you know, I mean, that's why I have, like I said in the pre-call, two masters and a PhD. There's no reason on God's green earth that I need two masters and a PhD to do what I do. Well, you know,
right.
So there's clearly something inside of me that says I need to prove myself. And that's kind of what I was trying to get to, you know, early on with that set of questions, was that it seemed to me, you know, because physically you couldn't do so many things, not you couldn't, in your head, you couldn't,
right,
that you wanted to prove to yourself at least that you could do other things and excel at those things. That's kind of what I was hearing.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. I don't think I was really ever trying to impress anybody else. I think it was more, you know, frankly, I think I just didn't care about what others thought. It was more, frankly, I think the key driver in my life has been my ADD. I just get bored, you know, and I didn't want to do something boring.
Amen, brother. Amen.
You know, yeah. So I remember the day when my mom said, you know, that they're hiring. It was when I was kind of finishing high school. And she says, you know, they're hiring down at this plant here, and they're paying $20 an hour to pack boxes. It's easy work. And I thought, you know what? Shoot me before I have to do that. It wasn't so much I was trying to impress anybody else. It was more that I was motivated because I didn't want to end up stuck doing something boring.
Yeah.
You know, with commodities of some kind or something.
No, that's pretty great. So were your parents like that? Was your mom or dad super driven, super professional?
No, my mom was a homekeeper and she did a great job. Like I say, she had seven kids. So she, you know, she's still around. She's 95 years old and she's an amazing lady. Yeah. In the same house that my dad built, but my dad was a mechanical engineer. He worked at Fender Guitars and he was just like Leo Fender. Leo Fender was a mechanical engineer and, you know, these guys went to work and you wouldn't know which ones were working on the production line and which ones were the engineers or the executives. They all just dressed in shop clothes. And, but my dad, you know, he loved it. He loved his craft, but he also loved making an instrument that, you know, kind of related to the other generation because all the rock stars would come in and he loved kind of, I think, that connection, but he was kind of a low key guy.
Did you ever have a chance to go to the shop with him and meet some sort of like rock star?
I went to the shop many times and I knew everybody, you know, or I was at least introduced to everybody on the production line. But my dad met a person, you name a rock star. My dad was he was in charge of research and development. So the rock stars would come in and talk to him. But the culture there was you never asked for autographs. You never, sure. And they, frankly, they didn't want autographs. They couldn't have cared less. You pictures, none of that ever happened. My dad would come home and say, yeah, I spent the day with this guy named Eric something. And my brother goes, Eric Clapton? And he goes, yeah. And you know, you name us, you know, Led Zeppelin, the Stones, everyone came through there. Well, and
dad really comes across as very uncool. Eric something or other, I don't know.
Yeah. No, but he was cool in his own way, though, because he wasn't. Yeah, he was just not that interested in fame and money. It was just he liked to help people, and he liked getting the, you know, seeing the, you know, musicians get excited about the getting the right vibe out of their guitars. But it wasn't about money or fame. It was just about helping other people get what they want.
That's awesome. So if you were to like think about your two parents, you know, we're always a combination of both. I always dread the combination myself, but for you, who do you think you're more like as an individual?
I'm definitely more like my dad. My dad had some entrepreneurial efforts, but with seven kids, I think he stayed pretty conservative to, you know, make sure everyone was taken care of. He did a great job. Both my parents, you know, I was very fortunate to have, you know, to have great parents that really did a great job. It's very funny. My dad took a class in drafting at Fullerton Junior College, the same school Leo Fender went to. And his class project, he designed our house, and then he went home, went and bought a piece of land, and he built it, you know, with this class project. I mean, this was a generation that was just really, talk about authentic. They were the real deal, you know what I mean?
Did we see like a World War II or Korean War?
No, my dad was World War II, but he had this background in drafting and engineering, and so he didn't fight. He stayed home and he designed the landing gear for the B-52 bomber. Yeah. So, and Leo couldn't go to war because a lot of people don't know it, but Leo had a glass eye. The army rejected him, so those guys stayed home.
Do you have this dad who meets every 16-year-old male's fan, Eric Clapton, Led Zeppelin, and you have a dad working at this amazing place, you know, and it sounds like he was super passionate about it too. So did that teach you this lesson of doing what you're passionate about? And I say that because, you know, my mom, for at least 16 years, had a job she hated, but she had four kids, and she felt like she had to work to make money, and she was the breadwinner, ironically, at the time, and so she always just kind of felt like she had to work, but she hated her job, and I got that every dinner and every night, and that just made me think so hard about doing what you're passionate about, not what pays the bills, and it sounds like your dad did that for you as well in a lot of ways.
Yeah, my dad had a big influence. My dad, he always really liked his work. He designed, before Fender, he designed Hot Wheels, and he always had cool jobs. He really did. But, you know, he loved working for Fender. He loved it. And I saw in his own quiet demeanor way, I saw how much he loved it, and that really kind of inspired me to, you know, get a cool job too, do something you really like. Because he never complained a single day about his job. He just absolutely loved working for Fender.
That's awesome. Do you play guitar?
I do. I played in a band. At the time, I had the hair, I had the guitars, I had the motivation, I had the passion. I just didn't have the talent. But yeah, I do play.
And is that one of your outlets in life?
I wish it was. I'm actually so consumed with my wife and my four kids, and we're going to London on Friday. We travel a lot. We have a lot of fun together. The book, my career, that I've wanted to start a band, but the reality is, and I'm sure you know, James, with a band, you know, it may look easy, but you got to practice that daily, and you either do it or you don't. And, right now, I think maybe in 5 years I want to start a garage band again, but right now is not the right time.
I think you start growing out your hair now, you'll play the part well.
Yeah.
So now as you start going down this path of, you know, and I love the stories about your dad and working for Fender, and I love that is your dad still alive? It sounds like maybe not.
No, he passed away at the age of 92, but he lived a nice, you know, terrific, great life.
Yeah, your parents have some great genes. That's amazing.
No kidding.
Oh, geez, yeah. Louise. And so, you know, you grew up in this family. It sounds like a loving, caring family. Are you still fairly close as you can with your siblings?
Yeah, my four sisters rotate and take care of my mom. My mom's in the same house. My mom's very mobile. She has her book club and does stuff. And yeah, we're having a big party in my house in the backyard this July to celebrate my mom's birthday. And yeah, we're all pretty close.
That's awesome. So, all right. So you have sounds like an amazing family. So I won't usually when I talk about families, I'm always looking for like, where's the real dysfunction? But your family sounds amazing. So what I want to move on to then is kind of learning more about this process that you do. So I was in New York. No one calls Staten Island New York, but I was on Staten Island when 9/11 happened, and. Mm-hmm. I took a ferry over, I want to say it was the next day or maybe 48 hours over to Manhattan. And I can remember just the smell is so specific and it's so tattooed on my brain in terms of that scene and the look and the smell. So when you're there, like, are you there? Do you work on these sites while you're there? Like, do you go to the sites of the disaster, or do you just take the data and work on it at home?
Good question. The answer is I always have to visit the site. I mean, the most remote site I worked on was the Bikini Atoll, where they detonated nuclear bombs. And so I flew out there, which is literally the most remote place on the planet. That's why they detonated nuclear bombs there. But yeah, I go there and do the field work, and then I go back to the office and I do a lot of, you know, research on the desk and that kind of thing. But I do spend a lot of time in the airplane. There's no question about it.
So what do you do in the field? Like, are you looking for the scope of disaster? You're looking for what was destroyed?
I'm looking at everything. I know it's not a helpful answer, but I just want to get, you know, I want to look at the factual issues. I want to look at kind of get the vibe for it. Like you mentioned, the smell in New York City. You know, I was there right afterwards too. And I remember the same thing. I remember being haunted by the fact that people were coming up to me with flyers looking for their loved ones. I mean, you know, it hits you very, very hard emotionally to see that stuff. But I just wanted to study the landscape, because I can do it. The more I know, the better job I can do of helping my clients out. And so I just try and absorb everything I can from every angle I can.
So how do you mentally do that? How do you mentally not hold on to some of these disasters?
Well, I first of all, it's perspective. I think of myself, right or wrong, I think of what I do as there to help people. I'm not there to gawk or take souvenirs or to exploit anything. I'm there to help people. And that's what keeps me kind of, you know, going in a positive direction. But I look at it just that simply. I'm there to help.
And so are there any one of these, and, you know, you've been to hundreds of disasters. Is there any, is there any disaster that stands out that does kind of haunt you a little bit?
Well, the one I don't like talking about a lot is Sandy Hook, because I worked on that with the school kids. That just, it doesn't get worse than that, you know, quite honestly.
Because that probably hits home, because you have four kids.
Yeah, I have kids. And when I was in Chernobyl, I remember stepping over a pair of white shoes that looked just like my little girl's shoes at home. And I thought, wow, this really affected, you know, real people. I think the most bizarre disaster I worked on was the Heaven's Gate suicide mansion. You know, remember the 39 people that committed mass suicide in that big house in San Diego? That was very bizarre, very strange. But I can't pick one. I think that there are several that all kind of get you on a different level for a different reason.
So, like, let's talk about, just 'cause I'm curious about the one in San Diego. Already just forgot the name.
Heaven's Gate, yeah.
Yeah, Heaven's Gate. So what exactly are you assessing there? Like, who's your client in something like that?
Well, every case is different. I mean, right now I'm doing cases for the federal government. I've done work for the federal government of the for Canada. I've done cases, you know, all over the world, Nuclear Claim Tribunal. The case in San Diego, my client was the owner of the house. His name was Sam Kuchisvahani. And, you know, he was just a real estate, you know, investor. He owned a few homes. This is one of the houses. He thought he had rented the property just as some kind of harmless monks. That's how he described it to me. These were just kind of quiet monks. And he was an utter shock when he found out that they committed mass suicide in his house. The media never reported it, but he showed me a letter that they had. excuse me. I'm getting over three rounds of antibiotics and a cold. But they showed him a letter of it was kind of a suicide letter, but it was kind of like a you're welcome letter. It's like saying, you know, Sam, we really like you and we're so happy we've turned your house into an invaluable shrine. And they hadn't done him any favors at all because, you know, with that kind of notoriety attached to the house, it was impossible to sell. And, you know, he took a bath financially on it as a result of what they did. So to get back to your question, I was there to kind of navigate things and get as much money out as we could from insurance companies and other resources and manage the real estate.
And so what happens is that you'll go in and assess the value loss based on the mass suicide and then try to get whatever's left back from the insurance provider or whoever.
That's part of it. I mean, yeah. Every case is the
agenda is a little bit. It sounds so complicated, by the way. It sounds very complicated.
Yeah, it kind of is. It is. But in the simple way that I think of it is that I'm first there to look at the numbers and look what makes sense and each losses and recover what you can economically. You know, I've gotten over the years, I've gotten billions of dollars from my clients. So we're pretty good at that. But the second part of it is kind of more the mitigation strategies. It's kind of the people side. You know, what can we do to make this better? And how can we manage through this whole situation the most productively as we possibly can?
Has there ever been a case where you've been upset with the end result?
A couple cases, but not very many. We have a pretty good track record. But there's been sometimes it goes to a trial and, you know, judges and juries generally, usually are smart. They get it, but occasionally they miss the boat and it's frustrating. But overall, I'd say 80-90% of the time we're pretty happy with what how it turns out given the situation.
So from a mental standpoint or psychological standpoint, are you able to compartmentalize all these different things, or do you go home and speak to your wife about it, or does she want no part of some of these tragedies?
I wouldn't say she wants no part, but the reality is it's kind of like a fireman sees a lot of traffic accidents and they're able to go home, hopefully, and, you know, have a successful evening with the family. I kind of look at it the same way. I'll answer the questions that they've got, but my family has seen so much of this that they don't ask that many questions, but I always have an answer about it, but I try not to dwell on it. Some of it can be pretty negative, and even though I'm there to try and make things better, I try and focus on the family when I'm with the family.
So early on in your career, though, I mean, were you still able to do that? Because I feel like that's something that maturity would show you in perspective, but when you first start down this path, did you find it?
Yeah, that's a good question, James, because at first it was, you know, somewhat shocking to see some of these things, and it still is. I'm not trying to downplay that, but for some reason, you know, we all have aptitudes. You have aptitudes. I have aptitudes. For some reason that I can't explain, I'm able to walk into the most mangled train wreck of a situation and just stay calm and observant and helpful. And for some reason, I'm able to kind of quickly pull together situations and aspects of it and make the situation a little bit better. What I'm saying is I don't fall apart when I see something, I call it a train wreck, but I don't fall apart. I'm able to kind of keep it together. I have other areas I'm weak on, but that's just not one of them.
So you're very good at compartmentalizing the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I try and stay focused on right now. Right now, you know, I'm enjoying talking to you. I'm not thinking about what I'm going to be doing tonight or next week in London. I'm thinking about this. I think that's important. A lot of time people are you know, spend a lot of time thinking about what happened in the past, the regrets or whatever in the or past glories. And some people are thinking about the future. I like to just focus on where I am at the moment.
Did you train yourself for that? Do you do like mindfulness exercises? Because that's not something that most people are able to do without some training, some focus, you know, parents berating you as a child, be in the now. Like, I mean, where does that come from? Like, that doesn't pop up usually.
Yeah, I didn't have any formal training. It's just kind of an innate, ability that I have. I like to stay focused on now. I'm not saying my mind doesn't wander. It does. But for the most part, I like to just dig in where I am and be productive right where I am.
That's awesome. I wish I had that ability. So I have your ADD, but the so for me, if I'm into something, I'm 110% like into it, but it has to be something really like the podcasting that I do. Like, I'm really into that. So
yeah,
I give a lot more energy probably than I should towards it, because they're in there just. I make no money doing it. In fact, I lose money doing it. And so I focus so much on it. My wife's like, are you going to make any money at this hobby? Eventually, but maybe that's the hobby part. That's awesome. All right. Well, listen, you've been great with your time. So what I want to do is I want to move on to my fast five. These are five random questions, slow as fast as you like. So are you ready to play fast five?
Let's do it.
All right. First job, question one, first job ever.
My first job ever was dropping off pamphlets for the Fuller Brush Man door to door.
I always like the follow-up question is, what did you learn from that? So
that I hated dropping off pamphlets door to door.
And by the way, that's usually the first response I get from 90% of the people when I ask them about their first job. All right. I want you to know you're the very first person to get my repurposed new questions for Fast Five. So there are only two questions I'm asking this time that I've asked every other interview I've done. The rest are brand new. So this is a brand new one. Who do you admire?
I really admire, outside of my family, my dad, I really admire Albert Einstein. I think he's a great, iconic man for a lot of reasons. But I admired the fact that he would go lock himself in an apartment for not 1 or 2 hours at a time or days, but for a couple weeks at a time and just think. You know, these formulas, these brilliant discoveries he made didn't come while he was watching TV or dinking around like a lot of people do. He was really a deep thinker. I really admired that.
The level of almost presenteeism that he had to have.
Right.
You know,
right.
It must have just been unbelievable to sit there.
Yeah. Now he had something going on. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And I gotta add, I'm really getting into, I'm studying becoming a historian of Leo Fender, because Leo Fender, you think about it, he's influenced everybody on planet Earth, at least who's heard a song. And he lives in the neighborhood. He lived in the neighborhood. But after he sold his company for an equivalent of about $300 million in today's money, he stayed right in the mobile home park where he was living at the time. He was very down to earth, very iconic thinker, a brilliant genius. And I think I'm starting to think Leo Fender might overtake Einstein the more I study his life.
That's awesome. All right. Yeah. Question three. This is my favorite question. What animal best describes your management style?
Oh, boy. I think what's an observant animal? I tend to be just very quietly observant. That would be
maybe an owl?
Well, that's too wise. I'm not going to give myself an answer.
Did you see that wall behind you? Come on. Really? Come on.
Let me see. I really like monkeys. I think probably a monkey. A monkey that's kind of the not the swinging around monkey, the kind of the laid back, kind of half dazed monkey.
Kind of like the orangutan.
Yeah.
There's some sort of negative connotation when I say, I feel like when I say that, but none meant. All right.
I got it.
Question four. What behaviors irritate you the most in your colleagues?
I think a lack of teachability, arrogance. I think that arrogance shuts down the growth potential in a person. And I think just being teachable, and I think the number one trait that drives me nuts is, I'm not talking politically, or maybe I am, but someone that considers themselves liberal and tolerant, but they are only liberal and tolerant as long as you agree with them. I like people that you can sit down and talk about the most, you know, outrageous behaviors that you adamantly disagree with and still have an intelligent, insightful conversation. I really like that.
I just laugh because I feel like that is our society in general. Like, you know, we are such in a phase of with or against, right? You're either with me or you're against me. And it is toxic and it's dangerous. And I don't think that, maybe this will sound arrogant, but I think because many Americans don't travel much, they are unfortunately a level of ignorance about other perspectives that could be out in the world, you know?
Yeah.
At least speaking U.S.-centric, and you get these same issues in other countries as well. It's not just the U.S. But, you know, we don't do everything the best. We don't actually have the best healthcare system. We have the best doctors. We have some of the best cures, but we don't have the best system. You know, we don't have the best education. You know, so like there's so many things that we don't do the best that as a society as a whole, we tend to think we are great at. And how dare you tell me we're any different? And it drives me mad. Question five. What kind of situations bring out the best in you?
I think this is going to sound strange, but it's just the truth. The more complicated and complex, I'm really drawn to those. I like the fluid nature. I like the thinking on your feet thing. I like trials, you know, legal trials where there's a, you know, a brawl over a large amount of money and it comes down to, you know, telling the truth, but telling it in a way that people can understand it, and being presentation friendly. I like complex stuff.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you for doing this. And now what I wanted to do is just spend the last 10 minutes or so talking about your book, you know, which was the main reason why you came on. I thought was really interesting is that I was doing some research about you. You had a book that came out, and I can't remember when it came out, but Rich Habits, Rich Life. And, you know, in that book, you talk about these concepts of me, we, do, be. And then,
right.
And then now this new book is called Me, We, Do, Be. So obviously this was born from the first one. So talk to me a little bit about the premise of this book.
Well, James, that's a great question. I'm going to confess one of my sins to you. excuse me. Still getting over this cold. I'm going to confess one of my sins to you. Rich Habits is the exact same book, word for word, as Me, We, Do, Be. What happened was the book came out, and people that read it said, this is brilliant. And I got lots of great feedback, but the title of the book just was not matching up with the content. Mm-hmm. So I talked it over with my PR people, and they said, you know what? This happens more than you realize. You need a new title. And one of my clients, he's a brilliant attorney up here in Orange County. He says, just name it Me, We, Do, Be. That's catchy. And I said, you know what? I kind of like that. So we talked it around and we republished the same book under that new title, Me, We, Do, Be. And it has taken off. I mean, I literally just got an email from a guy in Australia just this morning saying, I've just finished the book over the weekend and I'm getting a copy for every one of my kids. So it's the same book.
Okay. Well, and as I was watching these interviews, when you were talking about Rich Habits, Rich Life, that was the same theme that kept coming up. And I was like, I wonder if it's the exact same book that he just repurposed.
It is.
So that was a correct assumption. Okay. So
you're
right. So tell me then the breakdown here. Obviously the me, the we, the do, the be. And for me, that sounds very psychology.
It kind of is, me is our mindset. It's everything we believe, think, and feel. It's what we know intellectually, believe philosophically, and feel spiritually. We is our connection with other people, how we get along, how we connect culturally and sociologically and influentially, how we communicate. Do is kind of economics. That's productivity. It's land, labor, and capital and economics. But in other words, it's taking care of our money, taking care of our health, taking care of our stuff. And B is our game plan for moving forward in the future. And it's a very simple little framework, and it's supposed to be simple. But disasters happen, James, because one of these cornerstones is missing or is cracked. It's deficient. That's where disasters happen. And conversely, if you want to build a solid business, you want to build a solid family or a solid life, there's no way around it. You got to have all four of those four cornerstones in place, and then you can build anything you want. So it's just a simple little framework, but it's very, very powerful.
And so you use disasters as your pool of information to create these concepts, these four cornerstones.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm trying to think from my perspective, how does that, I don't think my life's a disaster, but how does my life reflect, this idea of me, we, do, be? So can you kind of give me some examples of how you're extracting these disasters and saying, this is what I find, this is how you can use it in your daily life?
Yeah, great question, James. The answer is, I talk about disasters because honestly, that's the world I know because it's the world I'm in.
Sure.
And I interweave those stories because, A, I think they're interesting. And secondly, a lot of people have a lot of questions and I feel a responsibility to kind of share. I've had a privilege of being to all these places and sharing what I've seen. But the book is also very much heavily interwoven with sociological studies, these classic university studies like the marshmallow test and the prison Stanford experiment and all these things. And then I talk a lot about examples from great lives, everyone from Harry Houdini to JFK and all kinds of people. So I do a lot of interweaving. Part of it is from my vantage point, which is unique, and I get that. But it's not at all about a book about disasters. It's about life and creating a solid foundation. And I just interweave a lot of stuff with it.
No, that's great. And it sounds like, to me, when I think about it, you can use different words for those, right? The me, the we, the do, the be. And it all comes down to how do you treat yourself? What do you think? How do you treat others? What do you do in your daily life to live it? And B is kind of, I always think of B as like in the moment. Are you in the moment? Are you living what you're preaching? Are you doing what you said, the strategies you laid out? Are you actually enacting those or tactics, if you will? And I think that it's a very, like you said earlier, it's a very simple concept. I mean, you shouldn't have to overthink it. Randall, what I want to do, and this is, I want to finish this, I want to let you go. I know you have a life to lead, so I appreciate your time and energy on the call here. But the last question I ask every single person is, I want to know how Randall Bell, Dr. Randall Bell, how do you define happiness?
I think it's balance, and I know it ties right in with the book, but the book really reflects how I really think. Me is taking quality time to just be by myself and think. We is, really making an effort to connect with family and friends, to spend some time volunteering with, I do a lot of volunteer work with homeless kids. I was just on Skid Row a couple weeks ago. I was just speaking at a high school with at-risk teenagers last week. I was just in San Quentin prison a couple of weeks ago. So volunteering, the building relationships, being productive. But the most important cornerstone is be always constantly exploring and moving forward in whatever your interests are, instead of just being sedentary and just playing golf and that's it. I think that describes me. Me, we, do, be is really the model I work for in my own life.
That's great. Well, Randall, thank you for your time and your energy to sit down and chat with me on Executives After Hour. It was truly awesome. So thank you.
Hey, James, I really enjoyed it. Let's do it again if you want it.
I'd love to. Thanks.